We are talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and we're talking today to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the new book Opera Unveiled, now in its 15th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
And we're talking today about the opera La Traviata by Giuseppe Verdi. And this is an opera which was done at the Santa Fe Opera in 2009, a spectacular production. And the look of it will be very similar, won't be exactly the same. But it's an absolutely wonderful story about love on, what would you call it, the other side of the tracks. Love between people of two very different classes.
In the middle of the tracks. So to speak.
Two people meeting in the middle. Tell us the source of this or sources of this story.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. Three stories, actually, to make up the story of La Traviata. It starts with a real life story, a story of a young woman called Alphonsine du Plessis, who lived in outside of Paris somewhere with a very abusive father.
This was a real person?
This was a real person. She was born in 1824. So we're looking in this whole time period of today's opera in the Second Empire, the time of Napoleon III, a time of hedonism that was unparalleled in history. Perhaps the Roman Empire could have matched it. But she was born in terrible circumstances. The father was abusive. Finally, she ran away and she ended up in Paris, where she had some very menial job. She could hardly keep body and soul together. But she was very beautiful and was quickly spotted. And set up by a restaurateur in her own little apartment, and she suddenly rose, I mean, virtually overnight, from being a penniless, abused young 15-year-old to the leading courtesan in Paris. And the way this was done in those days, you learned some of the skills of the aristocracy. She loved luxury. She loved learning. She loved art. And apparently she had a wonderful taste. So when she wanted furnishings and gorgeous china and jewels and things for her, she knew what she wanted. And because she was so beautiful, one man after another of increasing importance would make her his courtesan. In those days, a man was a feather in his cap if he had a very beautiful courtesan on his arm.
Define courtesan.
A courtesan is, today there's really no...
Kept woman?
A kept woman, a mistress, but more than that, not a prostitute. I mean, that's such a hard word, and women who were not courtesans would become prostitutes and barely survive and usually contract tuberculosis and die. So it was a woman who managed to rise up these ranks in what was called the demi-monde, the half-world. They were not of society, but they were women who could throw incredible parties, and their benefactors, their protectors, as they would call the men who paid the bills, would set them up in fabulous apartments. Marie Duplessis had an apartment in the Rue Madeleine, which is one of the more fashionable parts of Paris. They were never invited, of course, to aristocratic homes, but they did brush shoulders with the aristocracy when, for instance, they would go riding in the Bois de Boulogne in their fabulous carriages and horses. And at the theatre, that was another place. And she loved theatre. She was seen always holding court in some fabulous, with fabulous people in a box at the theatre. Franz Liszt adored her. He said she was one of the women that he could really have devoted his entire life to. But they were fickle, and men were fickle. You know, in her writing, she said that as long as they were popular with these benefactors, it was fine. But if they got bored with them, or if the courtesan ran through their money, suddenly they were cast off, and there was nothing. So they're looking for the next benefactor.
And that's sort of a theme in the operas this year at the Santa Fe Opera, because we also had that with Oscar Wilde, who was the toast of the town and then was suddenly cast out.
Yes, in another context. Yes, you're right. Yeah. It's something that sort of does tend to repeat itself through history. I mean, courtesans have been around since the days of the Roman Empire and probably before. I just talked about in the spring about the dialogue of the Carmelites, where Louis XVI was married to a Polish queen. They had four daughters. And he totally ignored his wife and daughters because he was running around with Madame la Pompadour. So it's nothing new. Kings, princes had mistresses. And the wives in these these situations sort of had to keep their mouths shut. They were also trapped, the women of the great families, because they didn't choose their husbands. They were rarely marriages of love.
Right.
They were alliances for wealth and lands and power, and the women were trapped, and they had very little interest, much to do with their husbands, who instantly went off and found mistresses or courtesans or whatever.
And women on both sides of that equation, whether they be the aristocracy or whether they be the courtesans, really are at the mercy of the ruling class of men.
Absolutely.
And the courtesans often were people who would have been just brilliant aristocrats had they been born into the right families.
Mm-hmm. And some of them actually were, Mary Charlotte. They were born into the right families, but they were indiscreet. They fell in love with someone and maybe got pregnant and then are cast out. So these women then become part of the demi-monde as well because they're no longer acceptable in their own society. So it's a terrible double standard. Men could behave exactly as they chose and were actually, you know, complimented on their beautiful courtesans, whereas if a woman had an affair, she was damned. And we'll see this actually again in The Marriage of Figaro. The count can have as many liaisons as he like, but his countess better not.
Right. So we have a real life source, and then we have some literary sources as well.
Yes, as she's rising to fame, and we have to remember this was a very short life. She died at the age of 23. I mean, she was very, very young. She died of tuberculosis at 23.
Good heavens.
She did actually, or the dream of all these courtesans, of course, was to get married. And she did actually get married. She became the Comtesse de Perigord. The Count fell in love with her. They went to London, were married in a registry office. His family would have absolutely nothing to do with this marriage, and they disowned him. And he didn't see much of her in the final years of her life, but when she died, it was her husband, the Comte de Perigord, who was there for her, who had her buried in the Montmartre Cemetery. And today you can go visit her. You can go visit her tomb. So in the course of all of this, there was a young man, Alexandre Dumas-Fils. The famous Alexander is the writer, of course, of The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers. That was the wonderful larger-than-life father. His son was a struggling writer at this time, and he fell in love with Marie Duplessis. And she took pity on him in a way. She, for her, this was sort of a novelty, someone that she didn't have to be beholden to all the time. And they had a very brief, very passionate affair for 11 months. But at the end of that time, she reverted back to her own, to the lifestyle she loved, a lifestyle of luxury, and it didn't work out. So the way he dealt with that was to write about her story, and he wrote the famous La Dame aux Camélias, The Lady of the Camélias, and he tells about her story and what happened, and in that book he discusses a lot of what the social situation was at the time. Later on, he went to take on some of these social issues. And the irony is that this young man who adored her had no money to keep her in the style to which she was now accustomed, became a very famous writer as a result of this book. She was called the Lady of the Camellias because apparently she loved these flowers, and whenever she was seen at the opera, they would be on the banquette in front of her. She never really answered to that name when she was alive, apparently. But at her death, some mysterious, unknown, anonymous man, presumably, left camellias on her grave every week for years.
Oh, my goodness.
Camellias appeared on the gravestone of the Lady of the Camellias. And this was the story that Giuseppe Verdi saw in 1852. It all happened fairly fast, which is unusual. I mean, she died, Marie Duplessis died in 1847, and then the story was written by Dumas in 1852, and Giuseppe Verdi saw that play in Paris, and it really touched a nerve with him. It became a very special piece for him. He loved the piece, and it was a change of direction, too. He created this opera very quickly. It premiered in Venice in 1853, which is merely 5 years after her death. I mean, that's unheard of, that it would happen so quickly.
Yeah.
But the reason for Verdi's coming to this piece and taking it so personally was a personal reason. He was in love with a woman called Giuseppina Strapponi, who had been a very famous singer And he had first met her when she sang the leading role in his Nabucco. And then they had stayed in touch over the years. He was in terrible grief at that time. His young wife and two children had died. And he spent quite a long time on his own until gradually they spent more and more time together and she was with him. Now, she was considered a woman with a past, a fallen woman, because she was an independent woman. She had had some protectors. She'd had some illegitimate children. And now she is seen with Verdi all the time. And this was one of the great love stories of opera. It was a real love story. When they fell in love, that was it for the rest of their lives. But they were not married. And, of course, in his hometown of Busseto, she was outcast. When she first went there, she couldn't even go to Mass on Sunday mornings without the entire congregation turning against her. It was terrible. So he goes to the opera to play, and he sees this play about a courtesan who's the toast of the town, as she had been, but who is ultimately suffering. And he takes this character and turns her into Violetta Valerie. And he shows the heartbreak and the tragedy of her story, which, of course, is compounded by the fact that she dies at the end of tuberculosis. So it was very personal. And up to this point, Verdi had not written these kind of operas. And it was a departure. You did not write about domestic situations. That, you know, you could talk, whisper about these affairs, but they were not to be presented on the stage. Again, the censors stepped in and absolutely insisted that this opera could not be done in the current time of the 1850s. They insisted it be put back 100 years, which didn't make any sense because there were no courtesans in that time.
Right.
So the whole opening was, Verdi himself said, this is a disaster. They had the wrong singers he didn't like. Apparently, the Violetta was a very robust, wildly healthy woman. When she's on her deathbed of tuberculosis, the audience simply laughed.
Right.
It was a disaster. And it was only a year later when they had a cast that he approved of, though still in this, you know, incorrect setting, that the opera became the enormous success it is today. I think we can relate to this opera on so many levels in all times.
Well, when I saw it, it completely blew my mind. In fact, it was the opera that made me start to really love opera.
Mm-hmm.
After watching it for all these years and sort of in a detached way, it was so real to me because this question of can people of vastly different classes get married and be happy, and what if you're the family of one of them or the mm-hmm. other and you don't approve, are you right? I mean, and there are really good arguments on
both sides
from real life. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lord knows how many people have sent their daughters away for a junior year abroad when they were getting involved with, quote unquote, the wrong person.
And that's still happening.
And it happened yesterday. It happened,
yeah,
it happened the day
after
tomorrow.
It happened to me. I fell in love with someone who the family deemed totally inappropriate. And,
yeah.
And they effectively put an end to it. I mean, they have great power. Parents, there's not a lot you can do.
And it's also, I mean, the question of what would have happened had she not died of tuberculosis, would they have lived happily ever after, is a question that you can go home pondering.
Yes, yes, it is. The chance are, with what happened to most of the courtesans, once their beauty failed, then they did slip back to being prostitutes. None of them saved their money, and they were destitute, and tuberculosis was rife. In fact, it was seen as a disease of people who were promiscuous, sexually promiscuous. There was a medical text in 1844 that said, you know, women who live this kind of lifestyle will get tuberculosis, and they have that beauty, the great dark eyes, the white skin with the pink spots on the cheeks, the red lips, which are all symptoms of the disease.
Yeah.
I mean, these women were sick, and yet the men thought this was the greatest, most sexually attractive thing about her. As they're wasting away, you know, and Dumas writes about this, too. The cure for tuberculosis, I mean, it wasn't just... The disease was not really properly identified for many years, and the cure didn't come till 1943 with streptomycin. So it was devastating when you got it. But they were damned, so to speak. You know, that she lives this lifestyle; it serves her right. She's got tuberculosis. It's God's way of dealing with it. So there was very little way out, and for most of them, it was a straight downhill road. If they managed to save money and manage it, which these women typically didn't, they lived for the moment. They didn't give a damn what people thought about them. They lived high, But it was a short flare in the sky, and then suddenly it was over, and they were left totally alone. She was. She died alone at the Marie Duplessis in a hospital with no one except a faithful maid at her side, a woman who kept a diary of her last days, and the suffering was terrible. She waited and waited for him to return, and he never did until she was dead. So it's a tragic story, but it's one we can relate to, regardless of how you dress it. I mean, there's an empathy, and Verdi wanted to show this. He wanted to show the beauty of this woman's heart and the circumstances. And I think maybe the first piece of music I'd like to play today is the prelude, the very beginning of the opera. There's a real sense of death is already hanging over her. It's a very beautiful theme that then comes back at the end of the opera in the death scene, and where she is, where you see her home, and you have a sense of where she is in her soul. But then suddenly it changes to a glittering waltz, and it's a party scene. So maybe we could play the prelude.
The prelude. Sometimes those are called overtures. Sometimes they're called preludes.
Introduction, yes. It's interchangeable, that term.
But of La Traviata by Giuseppe Verdi. We're talking to Desiree Mays. And we will have to say, and we will also demonstrate through our musical clips today, that the music of this opera is fantastic.
It is. It's very soulful, I suppose, is the word. And again, it's got away from the structure of aria and recitative. The whole thing flows as one piece dramatically. Opera by this time is moving into that sense of drama, and the dynamics of the play have to now hold up. It's important. It's not just about a singer coming out singing about how they're feeling and the next one doing that. It makes it actually a lot more accessible. And opera, too, of course, now is so accessible since we have the super title. And here in Santa Fe, the title is, as they sing in Italian, you can read it in English or Spanish on the back of the seat in front of you.
And if
you
which don't want, is wonderful.
Which is wonderful.
It's like watching a foreign movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's really opened it up. Though again, Mary Charlotte, I always suggest that people at least know the story before they go to an opera.
Which is why we're doing these shows.
And
which is why you've written your book, Opera Unveiled.
Yes, exactly. I think it really helps. You know, some of the plots are so involved and complex. If you're struggling with who's related to who and what's going on in the relationships, you're missing the music. You know, music is so visceral. It gets straight to your insides. And that's what you want to be open to, because that will tell you the story. Though very often in opera, actually, they're singing about one thing, but they're feeling something else, and the music will tip you off to that.
Oh, that's very interesting.
That's
something to watch for.
Something to watch for, or listen for, yeah. And in this opera, that happens a number of times. So Alexandre Dumas told the story of his love affair with Marie Duplessis. He called her Marguerite Gautier, and he called his hero Armand Duval, which is his own initials, Alexandre Dumas. And this is the story that Verdi picks up on. So then the opening scene is a party scene. She's a hostess par excellence. She's flitting around the room. The Baron, who is her keeper, protector, benefactor, however you want to use that term, is in the room watching her, but he's a bit bored. You know, some nights he'll come and spend the night with her. Other nights he'll go home to his family. I mean, he's married with a family, of course, and children. But he's not too involved with what's going on. And someone suggests that somebody toast their gracious hostess, Violetta, and he sort of shrugs his shoulders. He's not bothered. But there's a young man who has just arrived, and Alfredo Germont, his name is. He's a country boy. He is in Paris. He's been there for a little while. And he's heard about this famous courtesan. He knew she was ill, and he must have seen her in the streets because he kept calling on the house, leaving her flowers, and knew she was ill. Now, for the first time, he's in her drawing room, and someone asks him to propose the toast, and he's totally tongue-tied. I mean, how does he do this? So she's slightly amused. I mean, she sees and sums up this situation very fast, realizes that he's a little embarrassed and shy, but she coaxes him, and they sing a brindisi. A brindisi is a drinking song, and all good operas have great drinking songs. And this opens the opera, the great party scene at the beginning of La Traviata, the brindisi.
Viviamo, viviamo negli eti calici che la bellezza infiora e la fuggevo, fuggevo l'ora sine mia voluta. Viviamo e volti mi prendi che suscita l'amore poiché quello che ho al cuore
was the drinking song from La Traviata. Makes you want to raise your glass.
Yes, it does. Champagne, of course. I think that's the only thing they drank in those days. So at the end of the drinking song, she has this terrible coughing fit, and Alfredo notices, and she tells everyone to go in to dinner, and they all leave. He stays behind. He's concerned. You should take better care of yourself, he says. And he tells her he loves her, and she says, you don't want anything to do with me. I cost 100,000 francs a year, and I live in this wild lifestyle. I'm always happy, but I'm coughing blood. She is, and he's concerned. So she sends him on his way, but as she does, does so, she gives him a camellia and she says, when this fades, come back. So he's ecstatic. He has an assignation with her. And then Verdi does something very unusual. Up to this point, at the end of the opening act, there'd be an ensemble, a sort of a real build-up of everything that's happened to that point. In this case, he does something very different. He leaves Violetta alone on stage. The party's carrying on outside, off stage, and she is alone wondering. Suddenly she's thinking, what's happening here? Is it possible? Could I fall in love? It's strange. For me, is love possible? So they're always falling in love with me, but what about me? Can I? Could I take the risk? Could I give everything up? And she hears off stage, and I think you'll hear it in this next cut, Alfredo is under her window singing of the cross and delight of love, Croce Delizia, which is what love's about. It's always painful, love, especially in opera. So she listens to this, and then she suddenly shakes herself and says, no, Violetta, this is ridiculous. You can't do this. I don't want to give up the good life. And she ends up on this absolutely wildly incredible, difficult, stunning aria as she celebrates the lifestyle that she thinks she believes in. So the production you saw here, Mary Charlotte, I think had Nathalie Dessay singing Violetta, and she was so touching in this piece.
She was so beautiful as Violetta, because she's so tiny in real life.
Yes, I mean, being consumptive was totally believable with her. And this was her first Violetta. She then went on to sing it in many other places. It's a very difficult role for a singer, because you have to have that coloratura for this great aria to be able to do those runs and ornamentation. And yet it's also a lyric role. There's one wonderful lyric passages in it, so it's not an easy role. In fact, when she did it at the Met, the stage set was very bare. There was nothing except a great clock, and the hands of the clock were set at 5 to 12. And in the course of the opera, they just sort of spell the last few minutes of her life over those 2.5 hours.
Wow.
It was very effective. Usually you have the incredible set of Zeffirelli with the real scene of the demi-monde. And our production is interesting. It was done by the director Laurent Pelly. And he uses a series of boxes, which sounds extraordinary, but they're used in different configurations with great effect. The opening, for instance, the prelude that we heard, is a series of men carrying enormous black umbrellas, and they're carrying a coffin. And it's the coffin of Violetta at the very beginning that they carry across the stage. They leave, and then they go back into the wall. So this is I'm just going to play a little of the Estraneo, this final wonderful monologue of Violetta. And in this recording, it is sung by Nathalie Dessay.
Thank you.
That was Natalie Desay singing the part of Violetta in La Traviata. We're talking to Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe. And we're back with Desiree Mays talking about La Traviata by Giuseppe Verdi. And it's just an incredible opera in every way. Mm. I mean, theatrically, thematically, musically.
Emotionally, you do go out of this opera changed. So I'd like to play now for you, Mary Charlotte, an interview with Michael Fabiano. This is a young singer who he'll tell us a little bit about his own history and background and how he came to sing Alfredo. He is young as Alfredo was, and as is his Violetta in this production. Natalie Desay sang the last production. This year we have Brenda Ray. These are two young singers who are winning competitions right, left, and center. And I think this interview with Marco Fabiano is actually up on the SantaFeOpera.org website.
And he's the one who's actually going to be performing this summer at the Santa Fe Opera.
He's going to be singing Alfredo. And following his interview, we'll play him singing one of the arias from the opera. So you'll hear the voice that you'll hear in the summer. So let's hear from Marco Fabiano.
Well, when I was an apprentice here in 2005, it was the first summer that I had been away from college. I graduated University of Michigan in 2005, and I studied with one of the wonderful artists that sang in Santa Fe, at the Santa Fe Opera, George Shirley. And I came here right after I graduated, and I had a really terrific summer as an apprentice here. It was an eye-opening summer for me. I got to work with some really terrific performers and witness their grandeur as singers. And I subsequently went to the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia and studied there for 4 years. And while I was there, I won the Metropolitan Opera Competition in 2007. And I've been going from there since then. I made my debut at La Scala in 2008 as Linuccio and Gianni Schicchi. And it was wonderful, and surely an honor for a young person to make a debut there. And I did it while I was in my third year of school. It was very interesting because I made my debut at La Scala, and as soon as I came home, the day after, I had to go back to working in church. Finished the performance on a Friday night, and Sunday morning I was singing in church. I'm a singer because I feel a great responsibility to communicate art to a very big public and to a wide audience, a much wider audience than we see just maybe at the Santa Fe Opera, because I believe music in itself is intrinsic to humanity. As an opera singer, I feel it's important to communicate something bigger than myself, that music is bigger than just me, and singing music is bigger than me. It's something that's global, and it's something that it's important. And communicating to just the public at large and of a demographic of people that are over 50 is a very good thing, because we as opera singers depend on the generosity of people that are over 50. But in time, we're going to have to depend on people that are my age and younger. And so I feel it my explicit obligation, and I think it should be the obligation of many wonderful young singers, to reach out to people that are young, get into classrooms, get into schools, give people the devices and the tools necessary to make art something viable in education. Not just will kids be able to graduate because they're studying music or studying dance, they'll be given a greater appreciation of music and dance, and of all these specific arts that we pursue. In respect to Alfredo, I think he's a character that can be played in many ways, but he's a unique man because he's young, and he is smart, but he's young. And sometimes young people are not necessarily the instinctive people that have experience that are older are. And I think there's something to be said with Alfredo that there's a belief in young love, that there's not necessarily love at first sight, but there's a longing to be with someone. And probably this man has never been with anyone in his life before, that he's been watching this woman, Violetta, for a year, every day watching her while she's been ill and sick. And finally saying, I've been watching you, and you're so sick. Please deal with yourself. Please help yourself. And the fact is, I really do love you. We see him become a man in front of our eyes, even in his own failings, even in the mistakes that he makes, he becomes a man. And we see that at the end.
So that's Michael Fabiano, who is going to be singing Alfredo in La Traviata. And maybe we should go straight into hearing him.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it's wonderful to hear somebody's spoken voice. Let's go straight into his singing voice.
This is actually from a production, so you'll hear a little theater background noise, but this is Michael Fabiano singing Dei miei bollenti spiriti from La Traviata.
And so there you have the singing voice of the fabulous Michael Fabiano. Let's continue with the story because we've been talking so much. We need to finish the story.
Well, this aria you've just heard and all that passion from Michael, I think it's really going to be great to hear him sing this role. It comes at the beginning of the second act where Violetta's had a change of heart in the intermission and she's decided she will go away with Alfredo, and they get this little villa in the country, not too far from Paris, but outside of the hype of the city, and they're living there blissfully together. We see another dimension now too of Violetta. She has decided that it costs money to take a villa in the country and to live the way they lived, and she is selling her belongings in order to finance their lifestyle. So now the roles are reversed. Who is keeping whom? Which is a very subtle point that Verdi makes here. However, once Alfredo finds out about this, he goes rushing off to Paris to raise money because it's an insult to his manhood if she is paying the bills. As soon as he's gone, who shows up but his puritanical father, Germont, who is the baritone in the opera, and he has come to actually castigate Violetta. He arrives at the villa and he asks her straight up, "Why are you ruining my son?" And she is very elegant, and she looks at him and she says, "You're addressing a woman in her own house. I'm sorry, I must withdraw." So he hadn't expected this, you know, so he backs off, and then they start this amazing conversation. It's a conversation. He is there to convince her that it is over. She cannot have a relationship with Alfredo. And he uses all sorts of psychological ploys in which to do it. He reminds her that they really can never be married. She'll never be accepted. She can't have children. And she will get older. And once she gets older, Alfredo will stray and leave her. Now, this is an argument she understands, of course. So that gives her pause. But the turning point for Violetta is where Germont turns to her and says, "I have a daughter who is engaged to be married, but her family will not allow the marriage to go through as long as Alfredo, my son, is having an affair with you." So she says, "Well, maybe for a while I can sacrifice her. We'll separate for a little while. He says, no, it has to be permanent. So there's this amazing turnaround of a father, and she almost becomes a daughter here. She's never had a father, and here's someone that she would like to be part of his family, but it can never be. So they end on actually good terms, but he has made her change her mind. She's agreed to leave. And the aria that he sings, we'll just play a snippet of it here, is he talks about his pure daughter, and the gemma on this recording is the great Vladimir Chernov. So this act ends, and tragically, Alfredo comes back to the villa, and he finds Violetta writing a letter, and she's in tears, and he says, why are you crying? And she says, love me forever, and she flees. And he doesn't know quite what's up with her until a servant brings him a note, and she tells him that she has left and gone back to Paris. So his fury knows no bounds. He accuses her of going back to her old lifestyle, and the act ends in this terribly high angst as Germont tries to comfort his son, saying it's all for the best. We know those words, and he's heartbroken. She has left him. The next act, then,
without saying, I have manipulated her into it.
Yeah, he
sucker.
Doesn't. Yeah, this is the puritanical father who sends her back to the lifestyle that his son was saving her from and taking care of her. So the next act then is back in Paris. She has returned to the Baron. She's no other means of support, so she goes back to him. She goes to this party, and there's a wonderful dance scene where they have fortune tellers, and all of the courtesans are flirting with their men. And Violetta comes in on the arm of the Baron, and then Alfredo comes in. He's followed her, found out where she's going, and they have this terrible confrontation. She asks him privately, leave, or the Baron will want to fight with you and have a duel. He says, no, I'm not going to. And he calls everyone together. He calls the entire ensemble together, and he tells them in front of everyone that she had supported him, and now he is repaying her. And he takes the money he has just won on the gaming tables, and he throws the money at her, which is the ultimate insult. As she collapses, everybody rushes to her aid, and Germont appears, the father, and he says, you are no longer my son. You have disgraced and insulted a woman. So the whole act ends in chaos.
That Germont.
I know, terrible, both of them. So in the intermission, then a lot happens. There's a duel. Alfredo fights the Baron, who is slightly wounded. And in those days, technically, we're not supposed to duel, but they did. And whoever won would just do the grand tour of Europe for a while until everything settled down and then came back. So Alfredo takes off. He's no idea what happens. And by the time of the fourth act, this blow has been too much for Violetta. It's the last straw for her. Her health now is giving way, and it's the fate. Famous death scene, the ultimate death scene, where she's lying in bed with her faithful servant Anina and the doctor who takes care of her. And there's great tenderness between these people, but she clearly doesn't have long to live, and she's waiting for Alfredo's return. And Anina then comes in halfway through the act and says, are you feeling a little better? Are you feeling stronger? And Alfredo bursts in, and they have this incredible reunion, an absolutely fabulous duet, where they dream of what will happen, how their future will be together, everything will be fine. He has no idea how close she is to death. So this final cut I'd like to play for you here is where they're dreaming of leaving Paris together, and the Violetta is Patricia Racette. Marcello Alvarez sings Alfredo.
Come to me.
I have to say, it doesn't really sound like anybody's about to die, does it?
At that point, they think the future is possible. But she collapses, and he puts her back in bed. And at that point, Germont appears, the father, contrite and asking the forgiveness of the courtesan. So the opera ends with both men on their knees by her bedside, realizing it's too late and that she is dying. And in the very last moment of the opera, she manages to rise to her feet. Apparently, in medical terms, this often happens. And with tuberculosis, that the pain just goes away. And she says, there's no more pain. I feel happy and fine. And she stands. And as she stands and sings that wonderful note, she just slowly collapses to the floor. The curtain falls, and we're all left in tears. It's a marvelous
piece.
It's
true. And even the evil father says, gosh, I was wrong. You kind of want to punch him.
Yeah, but they father and son come for forgiveness at the final. So it's a very beautiful piece, and I hope that everybody will make it up the hill to the Santa Fe Opera in the summer. There are still tickets for this, of course. So,
Desiree Mays, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe and talking today about La Traviata.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
And I also want to mention that there are all kinds of things like backstage tours and family nights and things like that, which we just want to mention. And shuttle buses, no matter where you are, you can get to the opera without battling the traffic.
Well, Albuquerque, from Albuquerque and Santa Fe. There's a bus that goes. Call the box office. They'll give you all the details for that.
And backstage tours happen throughout the summer?
Yes, Monday to Friday you can just show up at the opera at 9 in the morning before it gets too hot, bring a hat and sun cream, and you will go all the way around backstage and see the props and how these operas are put together. It's a magical experience if you've never done it.
Absolutely. And then there's also family nights.
Yes, family nights is something new that the opera have offered over the last couple of years. They're deeply discounted tickets, which we can't mention on the air, but adults come for really nominal cost and for children as well. And the nights they're offering these are for La Donna del Lago, the Lady of the Lake, is July 13th. The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein, which is the funny one, the comedy, is July 19th. No, La Donna is July 13th. The Duchess is July 19th. La Traviata, we've just talked about. Bring an older child to that. It could be life-changing for them. That's July 24th. And The Marriage of Figaro, the family night, is August 20. So you just have to call the box office to find out about tickets for those. They're limited tickets, so call ASAP. The box office number is 505-986-5900.
Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654. And the local number is 505-986-5900.